So think about the experience of looking at a medical X-ray.
Okay.
Like when you
Yeah.
look at an X-ray of a broken arm, there is this certain comfort in the precision of it, you know?
Right, it's very clinical.
Exactly. The doctor puts the film up on the light board, and they point to that jagged, bright white line across the bone, and they say, you know, right there, that is the fracture. That's the problem.
Yeah, it gives you a clear answer.
And usually, when we consume a piece of horror fiction or like a monster story, we expect that exact same level of diagnostic clarity.
Oh, absolutely. It provides a framework.
Right? You have your vampire, you have your wooden stakes. You know, the rules of the mythology are clearly laid out.
You can point at the creature and just say, well, there is the monster.
Yes. And even in a terrifying narrative, if you can categorize the threat, your mind can kind of process it.
Because you are dealing with a binary state, right? Like human or werewolf, natural or supernatural, safe or in danger.
But what happens when the X-ray reveals something your mind just fundamentally rejects?
Oh, that's the terrifying part.
Imagine looking at that film, and instead of a simple fracture, you see a skeletal structure with an extra joint that just shouldn't exist.
A geometry that completely defies human anatomy.
Exactly. You look at it and realize the machine isn't broken. It is accurately reflecting a reality that is fundamentally wrong.
And that is the exact sensation of stepping into the world of Robert W. Chambers.
It really is. You just lose all diagnostic clarity.
You are plunged into this narrative landscape where the monster isn't a creature you can stab or shoot.
No, the monster is an idea. And worse, it's an idea that is utterly infectious.
Which is exactly why we are here today. Welcome to this book candy companion conversation from Clair and Horatio.
We are so glad you're joining us for this.
Today we are exploring the Clair and Horatio audiobook of The King in Yellow by Robert W. Chambers.
And we really need to set the parameters for our discussion right now.
Right. This is not a teaser. We are not offering a brief summary or like a light overview to help you skim through a syllabus.
No, definitely not. This is a spoiler-friendly, deeply analytical cheat sheet.
It's designed for the listener who wants to truly understand the architecture of this text.
So if you are an adult listener, a student, or part of a literary group looking to extract the actual marrow from this book, you are in the right place.
We're basically assuming you are either gearing up to listen to the Clair and Horatio audiobook or you have just finished it.
And if you just finished it, your brain is probably currently reeling from the implications, just trying to connect all the dots.
Our mission in this deep dive is to take those threads and weave them together, highlighting the historical contexts and the psychological depths that might not be immediately apparent on a first pass.
Because the premise itself is what makes this exploration so necessary, honestly.
Oh, for sure. The King in Yellow is a collection of stories bound together by this central, terrifying conceit.
And it's a brilliant conceit, the existence of a fictional forbidden play, also called The King in Yellow.
A play that is so devastatingly potent, so profoundly true, that anyone who reads the second act is driven irrevocably insane.
And Chambers takes this concept of cosmic mind-shattering horror and he crashes it directly into the gritty, romantic, and often starving reality of bohemian artists in 19th century Paris.
Which is just a wild combination.
That is the part that still blows my mind. The concept of a piece of media that acts as a pathogen.
Like a literal mimetic hazard.
Exactly. Isn't it fascinating how this 19th century text anticipates the dread of the internet age?
It's prophetic, really.
It's almost like the fictional play itself is the original dark web rabbit hole. You read a specific sequence of words, and your brain is permanently hijacked.
And when you think about the dread of the internet age, the fear of clicking the wrong link or falling down an algorithmic pipeline that completely warps your worldview,
Chambers anticipated that exact anxiety over a century ago.
the resonance is genuinely unsettling. Because we are currently living in an era defined by information overload and the virality of ideas.
We debate the psychological impact of toxic algorithms every day.
Right. We talk about the spread of radicalizing ideologies and concepts that, quote unquote, go viral and alter objective reality for massive groups of people.
And Chambers didn't even have the internet.
No, but he understood the fragility of the human mind perfectly.
He envisioned a book that spreads like an infectious disease from city to city. Governments confiscate it, the church denounces it.
But human curiosity just makes it utterly irresistible.
Take the very first story, The Repairer of Reputations. The narrator, Hildred Castaigne, literally throws the book into the fireplace after reading the first act.
Because he knows it's dangerous.
Right. But he catches a glimpse of the first few words of the second act as the pages start curling in the heat.
And he is physically compelled to reach into the burning coals to rescue it.
He is infected in a matter of seconds. The virality of the madness is just instant.
And Chambers situates that madness in a world that is deeply, uncomfortably familiar, yet totally twisted.
Let's talk about that world, because the Repairer of Reputations is often categorized as weird fiction, but it functions simultaneously as prophetic science fiction.
Yes, he wrote it in 1895, but he intentionally sets the narrative in the future, specifically the 1920s in America.
And let's look at his version of the 1920s, because it is terrifyingly sterile.
Oh, it's incredibly bleak underneath the surface.
He paints this picture of an America that has essentially perfected itself. The country has achieved a superb state of coastal defense. The architecture is beautiful and classical.
They've even dismantled the noisy elevated railroads.
Right. But this supposed millennium of calm and prosperity is incredibly dark when you actually look at the mechanics of it.
Because it requires a massive centralization of power. Chambers describes a society that has implemented a Prussian military system.
And for a reader in 1895, that phrase carries some specific heavy connotations, right?
Absolutely. The Prussian system was the ultimate mechanized, emotionless, highly regimented bureaucracy applied to human life and statecraft.
It implies a rigid hierarchy where the individual is entirely subordinate to the state machine.
Furthermore, this utopia is built on systemic exclusion. The text specifically notes the exclusion of foreign-born Jewish people.
It is a fascist state disguised as a golden age of peace.
And the absolute crowning achievement of this society, the thing they are most proud of, is the government lethal chamber.
They built it right in Washington Square.
Which is such a striking image.
It's described as this beautiful, classical white marble building surrounded by lush flowers and fountains.
And its sole purpose is to facilitate legalized, normalized, government-sponsored suicide.
The governor actually gives a ribbon-cutting speech. He literally stands there and declares that the community is benefited by the removal of despondent and suffering people.
It's the bureaucratic sanitization of death.
Yeah.
The state doesn't just allow you to die. It provides a beautiful state-of-the-art facility for it, framing it as a civic duty.
And the chilling part is not just the existence of the chamber, but the societal acceptance of it.
Yeah.
The citizens cheer.
It is a world where empathy has been entirely replaced by efficiency.
But wait, I have to ask. How do we reconcile that hyper-political dystopian sci-fi vision with the rest of the book?
That is the big question.
Because the King in Yellow famously suffers, or perhaps benefits, from a massive identity crisis.
It really does. It's essentially a tale of two completely different halves.
Right. You have the first four stories, The Repair of Reputations, The Mask, In the Court of the Dragon, and The Yellow Sign.
And these are the foundational texts of cosmic horror.
They deal directly with a forbidden play, the mythology of Carcosa, and this looming supernatural dread.
They're the absolute pillars of weird fiction. But then after The Yellow Sign, the genre completely and abruptly shifts.
It's literally literary whiplash. You turn the page, and suddenly the cosmic dread just evaporates.
It's gone.
And you are thrust into grounded, romantic, and often deeply tragic stories about bohemian artists living in the Latin Quarter of Paris.
We get stories like The Street of the First Shell, The Street of Our Lady of the Fields, and The Street of the Four Winds.
There are no monsters in these, no cursed plays. It's just people struggling with love, poverty, and war.
Which makes you wonder if you're just reading two different books that got bound together by mistake.
It certainly feels that way to a lot of modern readers.
But the key to unlocking the unity of the text lies in understanding the author's own background and the historical anchors he uses.
Tell us more about Chambers himself.
Well, Robert W. Chambers wasn't just a writer of weird fiction. He actually spent years as an art student in Paris.
He lived that bohemian lifestyle.
He did. So he grounds these later stories in vivid, deeply researched historical reality, which is completely separate from the alternate history sci-fi of the first story.
The Street of the First Shell is the prime example of that historical grounding.
Yes, that one takes place during the 1870 siege of Paris.
And for context, this was when Prussian forces completely encircled Paris, cutting it off from the outside world for months.
And Chambers gives us an incredibly visceral, boots-on-the-ground view of what it was actually like to be trapped in that city.
And he does so with a remarkable level of journalistic impartiality regarding the geopolitical conflict. We really need to stress that.
Right. As a listener, you notice that Chambers does not romanticize the political ideologies of the French, the Americans, or the Germans.
No, he focuses entirely on the human cost. He just reports the complex, high-stakes military tensions through the desperate, exhausted lens of the characters.
The narrative captures the fierce street battles, the frantic waiting for the Army of the Loire to arrive, and the brutal executions of suspected spies.
It paints this unflinching portrait of a populace pushed to the absolute brink. You really feel the physical toll of it.
We follow characters like the artists Jack Trent and West, and they are literally freezing in their garrets.
The desperation reaches a point where they're eating rats.
Yeah.
There's a specific haunting detail where a child is catching rats in the street and showing off a warm, bleeding catch to Trent as if it's a prize.
It's so grim.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, they are dealing with complex, morally gray figures like Hartman, an American German who is caught acting as a spy.
And he's swindling what little food rations the starving public has left. It's pure survival.
The contrast is undeniable. We move from a world where a play drives you mad to a world where actual artillery shells are crashing through the roofs of artists' studios.
But the bridge between these two wildly different halves, what ties them together, is the psychological profile of the characters.
Exactly. Both the weird tales and the Parisian romances explore the exact same human archetype.
The artist, the dreamer, the sculptor, the painter.
These are people living on the fringes of acceptable society, driven by passions and obsessions that inevitably consume them.
I see what you're saying. The protagonists of the supernatural stories, like the sculptor Boris Avane in The Mask or the painter Mr. Scott in The Yellow Sign, they are cut from the exact same bohemian cloth as Trent, Hastings, and Severn in the Grounded Paris stories.
They all share this profound fragility.
They're all chasing beauty or truth, and they're all ultimately broken by what they find.
Whether that truth is a literal German artillery shell or a metaphorical cursed play.
Precisely. The external threats change, but the internal vulnerability remains constant.
To really demonstrate how this works, we need to map out the plots of these stories.
Let's do it. Let's provide a comprehensive, spoiler-friendly cartography of the text, starting with a weird tale so you can track the descent.
Let's start with The Repairer of Reputations, which we touched on briefly with the 1920s setting.
Right. The narrative follows Hildred Castaigne.
And we learn early on that he suffered a severe head injury from falling off a horse.
He reads the forbidden play during his recovery, and his mind just splinters. He descends into absolute, unchecked megalomania.
He becomes completely convinced that he is the rightful heir to the imperial dynasty of America.
Which is such a wild leap. Hildred's delusion is fascinating because he weaves it out of a mixture of the play's mythology and his own real-world surroundings.
He allies himself with a character named Mr. Wilde. And Mr. Wilde is one of the most grotesque, compelling figures in all of weird fiction.
Grotesque is the perfect word. The guy is physically mutilated. He has no ears, only these wax substitutes that he constantly adjusts.
He's missing fingers.
He lives in this utterly squalid, filthy garret in New York.
And he shares this tiny space with a feral, vicious cat that constantly stalks and attacks him.
It's so weird. Yet, despite this pathetic reality, Hildred believes implicitly that Mr. Wilde is a criminal mastermind.
He believes Mr. Wilde runs a vast, invisible blackmail empire with thousands of agents.
And that he is the titular repairer of reputations, a man who can fix or destroy anyone's social standing.
Hildred is so consumed by the mythology of Carcosa and the King in Yellow that he begins to orchestrate real-world violence to secure his imaginary crown.
He plots to murder his own cousin Louis because Louis is technically ahead of him in this fabricated line of succession.
He forces his doctor into a confrontation that ends in murder.
The climax of the story is brutally stark. The grand conspiracy completely unravels.
Hildred is dragged away to an asylum for the criminal insane, ranting about his crown.
And Mr. Wilde is found dead on his filthy floor, his throat torn out by his own feral cat.
It is a pathetic, deeply unglamorous end.
It forces you to immediately question the nature of the reality Chambers is presenting.
But before we dive into the unreliable narrator aspect, let's look at the next story, The Mask, which shifts the tone entirely.
When reading The Mask, where a girl falls into a pool and turns to marble, it feels almost like a dark fairy tale.
It really does before it spirals into tragedy.
It introduces us to Boris Avane, an American-born sculptor living in Paris.
He lives with his friend Alec, who is the narrator.
And they are both deeply entangled with a woman named Genevieve. Genevieve loves Boris, but she also harbors complex feelings for Alec.
It's a classic bohemian love triangle. But the horror enters through a scientific, or rather, alchemical discovery.
Forrest discovers a chemical pool in his bathroom.
It is a clear liquid solution of unprecedented, impossible ferocity.
You see, submerge any living thing into this pool, it is instantly, irreversibly transformed into flawless, solid marble.
The imagery Chambers uses here is stunning. Boris tests it on lilies, on goldfish, on a white rabbit.
And there's this specific, eerie mechanism. When a living creature is submerged and turned to stone, a golden ray of sunlight seems to strike through the water, even if there is no window.
Boris coldly jokes that this flash of light is the vital spark or the soul of the creature escaping its physical form.
Which is so messed up. Thematically, it represents the ultimate destructive triumph of the artist.
Right. Boris is a sculptor who no longer has to chisel stone. He can simply freeze life into internal, perfect art.
But he ignores the moral cost of destroying life to create that perfection.
And the cost comes due. The love triangle reaches a breaking point.
Genevieve is suffering from a severe fever, exacerbated by the guilt of her divided heart and the suffocating atmosphere of their intertwined lives.
In a moment of delirium and despair, she throws herself into the chemical pool.
Boris discovers her, perfectly preserved as a marble statue. The horror of what his art has caused him shatters his mind, and he immediately shoots himself.
It is a devastating sequence. But what makes the mask unique within the weird fiction half of the book is its ending.
Chambers offers a rare, almost inexplicable moment of grace.
Years later, Alec is keeping watch over the marble Genevieve. Suddenly, the process reverses.
The marble softens, flesh is restored, and Genevieve awakens, resurrected from her stone prison.
It's the only time the cosmic forces in this book seem to offer a reprieve.
And contrast that miraculous survival with the sheer, suffocating doom of Envis in the Court of the Dragon.
Oh, yeah. That story drops the romance entirely and delivers a breathless, relentless pursuit across Paris.
The narrator of In the Court of the Dragon is attending a service at the Church of St. Barnaby. He is trying to find solace in the music of the church organ.
But suddenly the music warps. It transforms from a peaceful hymn into a dissonant, hateful, aggressive sound.
He looks up and sees the organist, a man with a stark white, malignant face, staring down at him with an expression of pure malice.
The narrator flees the church, but the organist stalks him through the streets of Paris.
It's a waking nightmare. Everywhere the narrator turns, the man with the white face is there.
The narrator tries to escape by running into the deep, shadowy vaults of the Court of the Dragon, which is a real location in Paris.
But the physical world begins to fail him. He realizes, with creeping dread, that he cannot escape because he is already damned.
The architecture of Paris literally fades away. The black stars of the alien city of Carcosa appear in the sky, and he hears the king in yellow whisper to his soul.
It is a profound depiction of absolute inevitability.
That same sense of inescapable doom permeates the final weird tale, the yellow sign.
But, you know, when reading The Mask, it feels like a fairy tale. But then we get to the yellow sign, which is pure, visceral horror. How do these plots even belong in the same universe?
It's jarring, but in The Yellow Sign, we follow the painter Mr. Scott and his model, Tessie, and they are being hunted not by an organist, but by the church watchman who guards the graveyard next to Scott's studio.
And Chambers gives us one of the most viscerally disgusting character descriptions in literary history.
The watchman is described as a plump, white grave worm.
He has a pasty, mushy face that looks like it belongs on something that lives underground. He radiates a scent of corruption.
Tessie is plagued by nightmares where she sees this watchman driving a black hearse in the dead of night.
And Mr. Scott admits he had the exact same dream, but in his dream, he was the corpse lying in the coffin inside that hearse.
What makes the yellow sign so uniquely terrifying is how the supernatural threat physically intrudes upon the mundane world.
Scott and Tessie discover a copy of The King in Yellow hidden in Scott's library. And like Hildred, they read it.
They realize that a strange black onyx clasp Tessie recently found is, in fact, the physical manifestation of the yellow sign.
It is a beacon. And once they recognize it, the watchman comes for them.
The climax is pure physical horror. The watchman doesn't just cast a spell. He physically attacks the studio.
His touch rots the iron bolts on the door. He batters his way in, kills Tessie, and savagely attacks Scott.
And the twist that Chambers drops at the very end is chilling.
The police arrive, and the doctor, who examines the watchman's body, notes with absolute clinical detachment that the man hasn't just died in the struggle.
He has been dead for months.
He was a rotting corpse animating itself to retrieve the sign. It is the ultimate violation of the natural order.
Following that intensity, we have a story that acts as a transitional palate cleanser. The Demoiselle Day.
It is a time slip romance. An American named Philip gets lost on the desolate Breton moors and somehow stumbles centuries into the past.
He meets a medieval noblewoman named Jane and her falconers.
He falls deeply in love with her. It's a beautiful atmospheric interlude. But reality reasserts itself brutally.
Philip is bitten by a venomous snake on the moor. As he loses consciousness, Jane tries to save him.
But when he wakes up, the time slip has corrected itself. He is back in the 19th century, lying next to a crumbling, centuries-old stone shrine dedicated to Jean.
It's a story of profound longing, dislocation, and the ultimate victory of time over love.
Which perfectly sets the emotional register for the bohemian tales that make up the second half of the book.
As we transition into the Parisian vignettes, the cosmic horror fades, but the themes of love, loss, and the pursuit of beauty remain central.
We've already discussed the brutal reality of the Street of the First Shell, with Trent protecting Sylvia during the military siege.
But look at the subtle, heartbreaking narrative of the Street of the Four Winds.
That story follows a lonely artist named Severn. He lives in a desolate apartment building. One night, he takes in a starving stray cat that wanders into his room.
And he notices the cat is wearing a strained collar, a woman's rose-colored garter.
This tiny, intimate detail leads Severn to investigate the room across the hall, where he discovers that the cat belonged to Sylvia Elvin, a woman from his past who he loved.
And he finds her dead in the freezing room.
It is a quiet, devastating tragedy. There's no monster, only the silent cruelty of poverty and misconnections.
And finally, we have stories like The Street of Our Lady of the Fields, which focuses on the loss of innocence.
It follows Hastings, a somewhat naive American art student who arrives in Paris expecting a romantic adventure.
Instead, he finds himself navigating the incredibly complex, often cynical, moral landscape of the Latin Quarter as he falls in love with the girl known only as Rue Barrée.
Hastings represents the reader in many ways. He comes in looking for the bohemian ideal, but he discovers that the people living this life are deeply flawed, hiding immense pain, and making desperate compromises just to survive.
Now that we have established the narrative terrain, we really need to address a critical issue.
Yeah.
When modern listeners approach these stories, particularly the weird tales, they often completely misinterpret the mechanics of the horror.
Because we are so heavily conditioned by modern supernatural fiction, where the monster is objective.
Exactly. If Stephen King writes a vampire, the vampire is real within the context of the story.
But Chambers demands a different kind of reading. He relies entirely on the psychological terror of the unreliable narrator.
The repairer of reputations is a masterclass in this.
Modern readers might listen to Hildred Castaigne detail his vast conspiracy and take his dialogue at face value, simply accepting that Mr. Wilde is a criminal mastermind.
But Chambers explicitly tells us not to trust Hildred. Hildred plainly states in the first few pages that after his head injury, his doctor, Dr. Archer, had him locked away in a private asylum.
And how does Hildred explain his release? He doesn't say he was cured through therapy?
No, he claims he was allowed to leave because he, quote, paid his tuition.
He insists his mind is perfectly sound, arguing that his intellect is superior to everyone around him.
This is the absolute hallmark of a narrator whose perception of reality is fundamentally irreparably broken.
Chambers forces you into the labyrinth of madness alongside the protagonist. So you have to actively debate the text as you read it.
Right. Is Mr. Wilde actually running a network of 10,000 spies ready to overthrow the United States government?
Or is that just a delusion Hildred has projected onto a pathetic, mutilated man living in a squalid apartment?
It is almost certainly a delusion. The grand conspiracy exists solely in Hildred's mind.
But Chambers makes it difficult by seeding in fragments of reality.
For example, Hildred claims that the armorer, Hauberk, is secretly forging a diadem for his imperial coronation.
And Hauberk actually does have pieces of magnificent gold armor in his shop. But wait, if the armor is real, you can't just write that off as a complete delusion, right? That's physical evidence.
Exactly. That is the trap Chambers sets. The armor is real, but its purpose is fabricated.
Oh, because Hauberk is a skilled artisan restoring antique armor for museums.
Right. Hildred takes a mundane, real-world fact, an armorer repairing gold plates, and forcibly weaves it into his megalomaniacal narrative.
The horror isn't that there is a grand conspiracy. The horror is watching a human mind desperately construct a false reality out of mundane pieces to justify its own descent into madness.
And this brings us to another subtle layer that modern listeners frequently overlook.
We get so caught up looking for the cosmic dread, the yellow sign, the cursed play, that we miss the banal brutality of the real world depicted in these stories.
The violence of reality often outshines the supernatural elements entirely.
Consider the physical confrontation in the yellow sign. The Watchman is a terrifying supernatural entity. But look at how the mundane world interacts with him.
Thomas, the regular, everyday bellboy of the building, gets into a petty fistfight with the Watchman.
It's such a shocking moment. Thomas isn't a hero fighting a demon. He's just a guy who got annoyed and threw a punch.
And during the scuffle, Thomas grabs the Watchman's hand and twists his finger.
And the finger just comes off. It detaches in his hand with a sickening, mushy tear.
It's not presented as a grand, magical battle. It's a casual, incredibly gross physical horror.
Or consider the grim reality of the Siege of Paris, which is more terrifying. The abstract concept of Carcosa. Or the very real image of a starving child hunting rats in the frozen slush of a Parisian street.
Chambers uses the fragility of the mind and the brutal, unforgiving backdrop of reality to deeply unsettle the listener.
The horror isn't just a monster hiding in the closet. The true horror is the realization that your own perception of reality might be fundamentally flawed.
And that the physical world around you is utterly indifferent to your suffering.
To understand how Chambers achieves this psychological destabilization, we have to look closely at the motifs and symbols he employs.
Let's start with the forbidden play itself. The structure of the play is incredibly insidious.
The text specifically tells us that the first act of the play is full of banality and innocence.
It is a literary trap. The first act disarms you. It presents a world that is safe, understandable, and perhaps slightly boring.
It lulls your critical faculties right to sleep.
And that false sense of security is exactly what allows the purest poison of the second act to strike the mind with such devastating effect.
If the play started with madness, the reader would reject it immediately. It requires the contrast to shatter the psyche.
And the physical objects in the world act as anchors for that poison.
Yeah.
The yellow sign itself is described as a black onyx clasp bearing a symbol that doesn't belong to any known human language.
It operates as a beacon, a physical manifestation of psychic infection. But the grander mythology, the imagery of Carcosa, is what truly lingers in the imagination.
The names and the geography of this alien world are incredibly evocative. Chambers gives us fragments of a nightmare.
The twin suns sinking behind the Lake of Holly. The black stars hanging in the heavens, defying the laws of astronomy.
The mysterious scalloped tatters of the king in yellow's robes. The enigmatic figures of Hastur, Casilda, and Camilla.
He never fully explains them, which makes them infinitely more terrifying.
But all of these symbols ultimately revolve around one central, agonizing tension.
The tension of the mask, the terror of hidden truths.
There is an excerpt from the play at the beginning of The Mask that perfectly encapsulates this. It's a brief dialogue between the characters in the play.
Camilla says, "You, sir, should unmask." The stranger replies, "Indeed."
Casilda chimes in, "Indeed, it's time. We all have laid aside disguise but you."
And then the stranger delivers the line that changes everything. He says, "I wear no mask."
And Camilla's reaction is absolute, unadulterated terror. She cries out, "No mask! No mask!"
Why is that so terrifying? Because it is the overarching tension of the entire book.
Because if he is not wearing a mask, then the horrifying, inhuman visage they are looking at is his actual face.
It's the horror of facing an unvarnished, objective truth that you just cannot comprehend.
Precisely. The mask represents the illusion of safety. It is the illusion of sanity, the illusion of the romantic bohemian lifestyle, the illusion that society is stable.
We all wear masks to function.
When the mask is removed, or worse, when someone claims they aren't wearing one, it exposes a reality that the human mind simply cannot endure.
The king in yellow represents that ultimate mind-shattering truth.
Now here is where we need to pivot and talk about the actual mechanics of consuming this text today.
Because reading the words of Robert W. Chambers on a printed page is one experience. But experiencing this text via an audiobook, specifically the Clara Naraschio production, completely changes the game.
It unlocks a dimension of the book that you might otherwise gloss over completely.
Chambers was a master of the auditory landscape. His prose is intensely focused on sound.
If you pay close attention, the descent into madness in these stories is frequently driven by specific, overwhelming soundscapes.
Let's look at Hildred and the Repairer of Reputations. He is absolutely obsessed with the sound of the armorer working in the shop below his window.
He describes the golden tinkle of the hammer on the metal greaves.
He says that the music of steel brushing against steel The mellow shock of the mallet sends a thrill of pleasure through him that stretches every nerve almost to breaking.
He is being hypnotized by the rhythm of metal.
And then contrast that seductive hypnotic sound with the violent auditory assault in the Court of the Dragon.
The church organ in St. Barnaby isn't merely playing dissonant chords. Chambers describes the sound as a heavy hand striking across the serene peace of the choir.
It is blaring. It is hateful. The narrator describes the music as feeling hunted.
When you are reading that on a page, you process the information intellectually. But when you are listening to an audiobook, hearing those words spoken aloud, it mimics the auditory hallucination of the character.
Hearing the narrator describe that church organ, it's like listening to a beautiful, soaring symphony slowly, inevitably warp into an absolute nightmare. You feel the dissonance.
Listening amplifies the rhythm of dread. Consider the climax of the yellow sign.
The dead watchman is stalking Mr. Scott, and he keeps repeating a single muttered question. Have you found the yellow sign? Have you found the yellow sign?
When you hear the text spoken, the repetition takes on a visceral physical weight. You can hear the oily, thick sound the narrator describes in his voice.
Exactly. You can't skim audio. If you're reading a book and you get scared, you can read faster to get to the end of the scene. You can skip ahead.
But with an audiobook, you are trapped in the pacing of the narrator, just like the characters are trapped in their fates.
When the narrator in the Court of the Dragon hears the footsteps of his pursuer echoing in the vaults.
Or when Philip in the Demoiselle d'Huys hears the faint jingling of the falconer's bells fading away over the silent, empty moors.
The audio format forces you to feel the isolation and the approaching doom in real time.
It creates a sense of immediacy. Similarly, in the Paris stories, the shrieking metallic crash of artillery shells tearing through the slate roofs.
The sound of glass shattering, the distant booming of the cannons.
Hearing those descriptions spoken aloud forces the listener into the sensory terror of a besieged city in a way that simply scanning words on a page might not achieve.
Which brings us to the ultimate question. What is the modern resonance of this book?
Why does a text written in the 1890s still possess the power to terrify and fascinate us today?
If we step back and connect the themes of the book to the bigger picture of human psychology, we see that the downfalls of Chambers' characters are always rooted deeply in their own obsessions.
The supernatural elements simply act as catalysts for their internal flaws.
Hildred Castaigne is consumed by a lust for power and status. He wants an empire.
Boris Yvain is consumed by the pursuit of perfect, immutable art to the point where he rejoices in a chemical that destroys life just to create a flawless statue.
Mr. Scott is consumed by his own arrogance, casually dismissing Tessie's prophetic dreams until it is entirely too late.
And we see the same destructive obsession mirrored in the non-supernatural Parisian stories. There is a profound resonance in the bohemian illusion.
We see young people like Hastings or Trent who travel thousands of miles from home seeking freedom, beauty, and artistic fulfillment in the Latin Quarter.
But their romantic ideals collide violently with the incredibly harsh, complex realities of human relationships, crushing poverty and literal war.
They realize that the mask of the carefree artist's life hides starvation, heartbreak, and desperation. The pursuit of the ideal destroys them.
It forces us to turn the lens on ourselves and ask a very uncomfortable question.
In an era where we consume endless streams of media, where we obsessively curate our realities through feeds, echo chambers, and algorithms.
What is our king in yellow?
What is the information, the hyper-reality that we willingly expose ourselves to that subtly, irrevocably alters our perception of reality until we can no longer tell the difference between truth and badness?
That is a remarkably heavy question.
And it leaves you with a final provocative thought to mull over long after this deep dive ends.
We spend so much time analyzing the king in yellow as an external threat. A demon, an alien god, a mimetic pathogen.
But what if the king in yellow isn't a supernatural entity from another dimension at all?
What if the king is internal?
Yes. What if the king in yellow is the ultimate manifestation of the artist's own destructive ego?
It is a force that consumes everything, love, sanity, morality, and life itself, in the singular, obsessive pursuit of absolute, terrible perfection.
Hildred sacrifices his family for perfect power. Boris sacrifices the woman he loves for perfect art.
The cost of their obsession is their minds and their lives.
The king isn't an invader. He is the reflection in the mirror when the mask finally comes off.
Knowledge is most valuable when it is understood and applied. I invite you to dive back into the Clara Nerdio audiobook of The King in Yellow, equipped with this new analytical framework.
Do not simply let the prose wash over you.
Listen closely to the unreliable narrators. Question their motives. Pay attention to the rich auditory details Chambers weaves into the text.
Look for the moments when the mask slips, both in the supernatural realms of Carcosa and in the freezing garrets of Paris.
If you do, you will find a text that is far more complex, tragic, and terrifyingly modern than a simple ghost story.
So step back into the diagnostic muddy waters. The X-ray machine is broken, and it is showing you a geometry that will keep you awake at night.
The truth is far more unsettling than a simple, jagged white line.
We explicitly thank you for joining us on this exploration, for lending us your time and your mind.
We direct you to visit clairenahto.com for more companions to your favorite literary nightmares.
Keep your mind open, but remember the lesson of Hildred Castaigne. Be very careful what you read.